Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
So what do you think when you hear the term payday loan? Ripoff, right? The same with check cashing services, pawn shops, and other so-called alternative financial services. And the typical worry is, how do we get low-income folks who use these alternative financial services into the mainstream banking community? Banks are good, alternative finance bad. Now, that's what Lisa Servon thought. But several years ago, she decided to learn more about the alternative financial services business. She got a job at Right Check in the South Bronx. It shares a block with two barbershops, a bodega, a store selling medical supplies, and a 99-cent store. And the experience was part of her education that led to a greater appreciation of alternative financial institutions and skepticism that mainstream banks are the solution. Lisa Servon is currently a professor of city and regional planning at the University of Pennsylvania. She is the author of The Unbanking of America, How the New Middle Class Survives. Welcome, Lisa.
Hi, it's great to be here.
And of course, I want to hear from you. Call us with your question, your comment at 651-227-6000 or toll free at 800-242-2828 and online at nprnews.org/live. So, Lisa, I love the book. It's
terrific.
Thank
you. Thank you so much.
So to start off, for our listeners, set the scene. Tell us about your experience at Right Check. You know, what was Right Check in the South Bronx, and what did you learn while you were there?
It was fascinating. I was at the time, actually still am, a professor at the New School also in downtown Manhattan. So, you know, I'm spending my days in this very different neighborhood.
Right, near Washington Square Park and Fifth Avenue and everything. Yes.
Yes, exactly. And, you know, one train ride away is this neighborhood in the South Bronx. It's a very poor neighborhood. It's written about as being a dangerous neighborhood, although I didn't feel that way personally. And I decided to do the job as a teller because I felt like it was the only way that I could really understand why people were using these services. You know, as you mentioned, I felt, and most people do, I think, that alternative financial services are predatory and the people who run them are sleazy. But it didn't make sense to me that so many people were using them and using them in increasing numbers if they were bad for them. I'd done a lot of research on urban poverty, and what I knew from my own experience of 20 years in the field was that people who don't have very much money know where every penny goes. And
yeah.
So it struck me that there had to be a real reason. I thought it would be a little bit like my previous jobs in the service sector, you know, cleaning hotel rooms, waiting tables, that sort of thing. It was much harder. I was dealing with thousands of dollars in my drawer every day, which made me very anxious. But I learned what I needed to learn by getting up really close and seeing kind of the texture of the transactions and what people were coming for. And when I also, after my 4 months working there, I went out from behind the counter and I interviewed lots and lots of customers. And what they told me was that they used the check casher instead of the bank or in addition to the bank because it was cheaper, more transparent, and gave them much better service.
Okay, so let's go this cheaper because
yeah.
Now, why don't you describe, what is a check cashing service?
So a check cashing service, they exist in every state. Their primary business is taking your check, usually not personal checks, but checks from your job or from the government, and cashing them. And they make a little money on that, right? So where I worked in New York State, these are all regulated at the state level. The fee for cashing a check was 1.95% of the face value, right? So a $100 check would cost you $1.95 to cash it. We also sold money orders. We did, sent money overseas or to other parts of the country. We sold scratch-off tickets, lottery tickets, and Metro cards, and loaded up people's prepaid debit cards as well.
So
mostly things related to the financial services industry, yeah.
Okay, so $1.95. You have a $100 check. It costs you $1.95 to cash it in. Now, how can this be better than going to a Wells Fargo or a Citibank, you know, what a big financial institution?
The primary reason is that you get your money immediately, right? I have a paper check from my job. I don't have much money in my bank account. I need that money right away to pay bills or buy food for my family. And if I deposit it into my checking account, it's going to take 3 or 4 days to cash, and I cannot afford to wait. So if you think about it, people are paying for getting their cash right away. It's time, right? And that time, when you don't have a lot of money, is worth a lot.
So one of the things I found really interesting in your book was how many small businesses use the check cashing service, plumbers, electricians, you know, the small businesses that make a city work.
Right, exactly. Yeah, and I tell the story of this guy, Carlos, who came in one day with, you know, a pretty big check, $5,000. You know, if you do the math, it cost him about $197 to cash that. And I just thought, like, wow, that's a lot of money to leave on the table, you know?
Yeah.
And after he left and tipped me, I might add, it's a little different from the bank also, I asked one of my fellow tellers why he would do that. You know, I said, he's got to have a bank account with a business like that. And she said, well, you know, it's Thursday. He probably needs to pay his guys tomorrow. And I could remember, you know, my own contractors walking around, coming to my house when I was getting a renovation done and paying the guys in cash. They either don't have a bank account, they might be undocumented. And also, oftentimes, these small business people also need their money immediately. So it might have been the case that Carlos needed to buy supplies for a job, you know, sheetrock or paint or something. And if he didn't get it right away, he might not have won the bid.
Okay.
So again, it makes a lot of sense.
So then you went to Oakland, California, the other coast, another low-income neighborhood, and you worked in a more controversial service, a payday lender.
That's right. And just for listeners who might not understand, I don't know, are payday loans legal in Minnesota? I should know this. They're not legal in New York,
and
in about 13 states, they're illegal. They are legal in California. So, yeah. So I went that's why I went to California to work as a payday lender.
So now this is very different because here people are taking out short term loans at a very high interest rate if you annualize it.
That's right.
Which is a lot of the controversy surrounding it. And there's this genuine fear that what happens is that people become permanently indebted. It's an equivalent of legal loan sharking, and people can never get out of that debt.
That's right. So you are absolutely right that payday loans are much more controversial than check cashers. I would separate them out. In fact, even though I kind of talk about them in the same sentence sometimes, for listeners who don't really get it, the payday term refers to the fact that most people get paid every 2 or 4 weeks. And so that's the term of the loan. You're getting a loan of anywhere between $50 and about $300. And where I worked in California, the cost of the loan was $15 per $100 borrowed, right? So, yes, annualized, usually it's between 300 and 600% APR.
Right.
So it is expensive. One thing that I think people need to pay attention to as well is to really think about the comparison cost. So, another reason that's related to why people use check cashers, for example, is that, you know, if you deposit your check and you don't know when it's going to cash and you're trying to pay bills, you could easily overdraft. An overdraft is essentially a short-term loan as well. So, you know, the other thing I could do if I need a little bit of money is to write someone a check. Let's say I'm getting my car fixed, knowing that it's going to cash. Knowing that it's going to bounce, then I'll be charged something like $27 to $35. So, and if you annualize that as an interest rate, you'll come up with 5,000%. So this is kind of a long answer, but you know, if you're comparing 500% to 5,000%, we need to look at these things next to each other, not just as the predatory loans are bad. However, you know, I don't want to be seen as in a position of necessarily defending them. I think the real problem with payday loans, as you mentioned, comes with the fact that many people cannot pay them off at that 2-week or 4-week deadline when they come due. They usually, the traditional payday loan comes due all at once in a lump sum payment. And so what people end up doing is they borrow that $100 again and pay another $15. And so that's called a rollover. And I think what consumer advocates and policymakers are concerned about is that once you've rolled over that loan a few times, you're no longer using it the way it was advertised. It's no longer a very short-term loan. And so there's a concern about whether these products are being sold as something that they're not really, and whether they do build up this debt that people have a hard time getting out of.
It was interesting. I read Hillbilly Elegy by J.D. Vance.
Yeah.
And in there he has toward the back a segment where he's really angry at the consumer advocates who look down on payday loans because he was using them and for a period of time got him through a rough patch. And then he was able, however, to move on. But he thinks this sort of immediate dismissal of this kind of financial services is underestimating just how thin the margin is that most people are operating at.
Yeah, I mean, more than half of Americans are struggling financially, live paycheck to paycheck, could not come up with $500 in the event of an emergency. And I agree with Vance. I think, you know, a lot of times we look at the product or the lender and judge them and without also looking at the situation that the borrower is in. And we also, you know, need to kind of separate out this group of borrowers. Perhaps people who are perpetually unstable and can never pay back that loan shouldn't get it. And actually, we're headed down that road with some new rules that are coming down the pike from the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. But there are other people, many people that I talked to, who said, I'm really glad it was there for me when I need it because I had no other option. And so I think it would be great if we developed other options that are better. Right now, we don't have them.
Now, so one of the things, you have this wonderful anecdote that you open up at the Pulaski Savings and Loan. I think it's in New Jersey. And you're opening up an account with your father. And, you know, I had the same same experience. And, you know, lots of people do. But then, you know, there's a certain amount of this nostalgia. I can go along a certain way. But then again, you know, these community bankers are great so long as you look like them. And
absolutely.
If you were a minority, forget about it. If you're a woman, as you mentioned, and up until, what, the 1970s, you couldn't get a credit card.
1974.
Unless your husband signed off on it. So, yeah, there's kind of this nice aspect to it, but only if you were in a certain segment of our economy.
That's right. That's right. So, you know, I do kind of paint this nostalgic picture at the beginning, but you're absolutely right. And I think, I kind of go on to talk about the discrimination that still exists, right? That African-Americans are targeted more for subprime mortgages, for debt collection. Women are still paying more for credit than men. African-Americans and Latinos lost way more as a percentage of their assets than white families did after the crisis. So this is still a problem. But you're right. We've never had a banking system that's really equal access to safe, affordable financial services.
And by the way, Lisa, got a nice correction from Mark in Minnetonka. He's an attorney. And what he says is that payday loans are partially legal in Minnesota. They're called small consumer loans in Minnesota. So the important thing is lenders have to be licensed by the Minnesota License of Commerce.
Right.
Department of Commerce.
And this is actually true for most, you know, these are called money serving businesses. All states regulate them. They're not actually allowed to take deposits. So neither are check cashers. So, you know, that's partly the way they're regulated.
So at the core, your story is really about increasing financial fragility among Americans. I mean, incomes aren't growing and we're all kind of outside of a certain upper echelon of society, but more and more of us are kind of filling in our financial gaps some form or fashion, and the alternative financial services is responding to a demand.
Exactly, exactly. And it's one of my points is that, you know, if we wiped all these businesses off the map immediately, the demand wouldn't go away. And I think, you know, only focusing on the consumer financial services industry doesn't give you the whole picture. As you mentioned, we've had declining wages since the 1970s. Income volatility has doubled over the past 30 years, meaning people really can't predict, sometimes even from week to week, what money will be coming in the door. And we've seen a real retraction of the public and private safety nets. You're less likely to get a job these days that gives you good benefits, pays you a living wage, and allows you to save for retirement. And so, again, you know, it's not really the people that need to learn more financial literacy. They need more money.
Yes. So you can join the conversation by calling us with a question or comment at 651-227-6000 or toll-free at 800-242-2828. And Tracy Mumford is in with me in the studio, and I guess some people have gone online at nprnews.org/live.
Yeah, so we have a question online from Jeff who's wondering if the tech sector can make any impact in the unbanking movement. Is there a possible solution coming from the tech sector on this, or is it really about just regulation between the institutions that we have?
That's a great – so what do you think, Lisa?
It's a great question. And yeah, we are seeing a lot of innovation in the tech center. In fact, it's kind of called FinTech is the little – abbreviation that people use. I can tell you about a couple of things. I mean, well, let me set the context a little bit. We have a ton more data about people than we ever did. That can be a little bit sort of
creepy.
Big brotherish, a little creepy. But there are people who are using it for good. One of the tech innovations that I really like that uses big data is a change in the way credit scores are done. I talk in the book about a small company called L2C that was bought by TransUnion, one of the three biggest credit bureaus, and they are using alternative data, not just the things that the credit bureaus usually base your FICO score on. So things like your rent and utility payments. They're also looking at consumers for a broader length of time than just a one-day snapshot. And what they're finding when they employ that different credit scoring methodology is that all of the people, and these are millions of people right now, are the FICO score is unable to score them. The data doesn't exist. So this method, I think it's called Credit Vision Link, is the product that they're testing out right now.
That's right.
Is able to score all of those people. And it also, when you rescore the subprime people, they move into the prime or super prime category, many of them, not all of them. So right there, you have kind of a tech innovation that is giving many more people access to cheaper, better credit. Another one that I like, and so there are products and services, but these two are kind of about the infrastructure, is a company called Ripple that's based in San Francisco. And what Ripple is doing is using a kind of blockchain technology that's used for Bitcoin to create a system in which all financial services firms could share a unified kind of ledger that would enable you to send money or cash that check and get it immediately and without cost. So Chris Larson, who's the president of Ripple, calls it an internet of value. So if you just think about the way information moves over the internet, money would move the same way. So there you go. If that gets adopted, then suddenly that issue that Carlos and other people at the check casher talked to me about of not being able to wait to get their money goes away. And you could have more people using banks potentially at a cheaper cost. And I could talk for the rest of the hour about other fintech innovations, but absolutely, there's good things happening.
Okay, so let's now go to the opposite end of fintech. 19th century, you know, there were these scores of small Bulgarian, Irish, Croat, Hungarian, Polish, Slovak savings societies. We built out the immigrant communities. And here in the Twin Cities, Thrivent Financial came out of the Norwegian Lutheran Church of America. So you write about these mutual aid groups that are rooted in our immigrant communities. You know, how big is this? I mean, how big a phenomenon is this sort of mutual aid societies among immigrants?
It's very big. It's also very hard to measure. So it's hard to know exactly how many people are using them. Although the World Bank came out with a statistic a couple of years ago that said 6% of Americans over the age of 15 save in informal lending and credit associations. We see it happen. It's very interesting because there are 200 names for these things. They're called ROSCAs, Rotating Savings and Credit Associations, worldwide. They were mostly brought to the United States by immigrant groups. But now what we see, and I think this is a relatively recent phenomenon, is that people are starting them in their workplaces. So, you know, you have some that are really rooted in community, and it might only be Thai people or Brazilian people or Ethiopian people. But now people are bringing them into the workplaces. I interviewed interviewed a woman a little while ago who works at a community college in the Bronx, and she's got money that she's collecting every week from 40 people in her office and keeping track of it and, you know, giving them reports. And it's completely informal. These are all people who have bank accounts, who get direct deposit, and have still found that this is a better way for them to have the discipline to save. So I think there's a combination of things about that, perhaps filling a market gap, that there's a discipline involved and you can't get your money back because she's holding on to it. Also, people sometimes trust each other, trust their networks more than they trust banks.
Tracy?
Yeah, so if you have had an experience with check cashing places or payday loan places, go ahead and give us a call. That's 651-227-6000 or toll free at 800-242-2828. You can also find us online at nprnews.org/live. And Derek from Egan called and said that when I was in college, I was in a tough financial situation and I had to get cash advances. I thought they were very predatory. Why aren't they more regulated? Anyone in any socioeconomic class can fall into these traps like I did.
Lisa?
Well, I think it goes to the lack of transparency. And I think Derek is probably talking about these cash advances that you get from when you have a bank and they'll send you these things that look like checks that you can just fill out and it seems super easy. I think a lot of people don't realize when they're writing that check to themselves the kind of interest that they're paying. Similarly, when you open a new checking account, the disclosure agreement that banks are required to give you is 40 some pages long. And so it's very hard for people to keep up with the fine print and to know exactly what they're paying for. And there are very few places that you can go to get that information easily. I mentioned this Consumer Finance Protection Bureau a little bit earlier. They do provide a lot of good information. I also like a website called nerdwallet.com that helps people with these sorts of things. But there is definitely a need for greater transparency. One of the things I recommend in my book is that all financial products and services come with very simple kind of information boxes, like the nutrition boxes that we see in the supermarket on tomato sauce or cereal or spaghetti, that tell us exactly what is in that product. How much are you paying for it? What's the interest? What's the fee for whether you're late, so that it's not buried on page 22 of that disclosure agreement?
So one of the things sort of in your book, we are starting to deal with, what do we do? And regulation is always a natural response. You know, we need to regulate this. And yet that is also an unhealthy dynamic. I mean, in somewhat fairness to the banks, you get regulations, which lead to more regulations, which lead to more regulations. And then how do you get around the regulations? So you get into this sense that, you know, just more regulation isn't going to solve this problem.
Yeah, I mean, unfortunately, this is kind of the way that policy is made. It's always very incremental. And so what we have now is a system of regulation that includes five federal agencies that's been created as a result of this kind of incrementalism. What I'm concerned about in this current discussion of regulation is that, you know, if you trace the problems and the cost of financial services, which I do in one of the chapters in my book, you realize, and, you know, I was not a kind of banking scholar before I did this. I was a poverty scholar. So I really had to learn it myself with the help of some great people, but realized that the moment that we start getting a lot of deregulation in the 80s is when things start to turn. And right now we're in a situation that is threatening a lot more deregulation with the Trump administration. One of the best things that's happened for consumers in the last 50 years is the creation is the Dodd-Frank regulation and the creation of the CFPB, which I keep mentioning over and over again for good reason. Two things about it that are critical. One, it's the only federal regulatory agency that puts consumers at the core of its mission. Its entire mission is to protect consumers, and it's returned $27 billion. I think I'm getting that right, to about 12 billion people since it was created 5 years ago. The second thing that's really important about it is that it has jurisdiction both over banks and all other kinds of financial services companies, credit bureaus, payday lenders, auto title lenders, check cashers. And so, but right now, you know, we're that yeah. narrative, that story of more regulation, too much regulation is being used to potentially kill it. And I think that would be a big mistake.
Okay. Well, on this topic of regulation, I think we have time to take a call from Russ in Spicer, Minnesota. Russ?
Good morning.
All right. What's your comment, please?
Yes, I just want to comment on Tracy's research and book. I do own a check cashing store and a payday lending office, and we are highly regulated by the state of Minnesota. Our rates are set by the state. We must apply, receive background checks, and et cetera. We even have to be approved by the city. Our application for that goes right into the city.
And so, is your business, is it located in Spicer, or are you around the state?
No, it's in Wilmer, which is 15 miles away.
Okay.
But, we do absolutely perform a service to people that just don't have anywhere else to turn. And it's very competitively priced.
Thank you. Lisa?
I think the caller is probably reflecting a little bit of what I saw.
Yeah.
Now, you know, I did mention that the CFPB is for the first time coming down with a set of rules to regulate payday lending on a national level. I think that's good. I think having federal regulation on these businesses is a good thing. A lot of that regulation will take care of some of the things that people are concerned about. For example, it's creating a rule that will require lenders, all lenders, the payday lenders, to figure out whether the consumer, the potential borrower, has the ability to pay back that loan. And that, I think, will also make the market more competitive because in order to figure out if somebody has the ability to pay, it takes a little bit of time. You know, when I worked at the payday lender, we were giving people money within 5 or 10 minutes. And so if you have to check about whether they can pay it back, that's going to take a little bit more time and create competition from other lenders who are already doing a little bit of underwriting, and it should lower the price for people.
All right. Now let's go to Gina in Plymouth. What's your comment?
Hi. Great conversation. And I just wanted to start by saying that I lived out west. I was in California and Nevada and have both used the payday loan services and the check cashing. And what I had spoke earlier to the staffer that the payday loans actually were critical as a bridge gap for me for several things, for rent, for electric bills, for other utility bills, because the fact was I didn't have the credit score to get a credit card or a credit line or a small loan. So I do see the advocacy on that. I also got stuck into getting multiple loans to pay on other loans. It took a few months, but I was able to finally come out of that cycle. So I do see the benefits overall and long term, and I can see where the pitfalls occur. Here's my question, though.
Yep.
You're not – there's very little microloans. They are done abroad. I donate to an organization that does these abroad. But if the credit limits do not come down and the qualifiers and quantifiers don't come down, people like that can't get these short-term loans. Do you know of any companies that are doing microloans domestically for people that have bad credit scores?
Yeah, that's good. What do you think? What about these microloans? In about a minute, Lisa.
Sure. So microlending in the U.S. is primarily focused on small business development, and I've done a lot of work on those.
And I guess we get a definition first of a microloan.
Very small loans to usually low-income people to usually start their own businesses. There are a couple of other firms, one that I mentioned in the book called Opportune, that does small payday-like loans for a lot less money for about a 36% interest rate. I think that's a potential place for the market to go, particularly when these payday lending rules come around. Another business called Fenway Summer that's come out with a credit card called the Build Card, targeted specifically to subprime borrowers. So those are a couple things to look for.
Yes. And the microloan, I mean, we tend to think about microloans in terms of India, Bangladesh, emerging markets. And yet it can make a lot of sense in poorer neighborhoods here in the U.S.
That's right. I think the fact that it's mostly been focused on small businesses, there is no microlending program in the United States that I know of that covers its own cost. So they're all subsidized, which is a disincentive for a real business to spring out of it.
Well, thank you very much for your time. I really appreciate it.
This has been great. Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
Lisa Servin is professor of city and regional planning at the University of Pennsylvania, and she is the author of The Unbanking of America: How the New Middle Class Survives.